Runoff, a crime novel about election fraud, evokes a curious timelessness of classic detective fiction. A noir gem, says Mystery Scene Magazine. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 6, Election Fraud for Dummies. Going to meet Professor Ballou at Stanford University meant getting the Galaxy 500 from the seedy Tenderloin garage where I parked it and hoping it would hold up for the drive down the peninsula to Palo Alto. It also meant picking up my friend Chris Duckworth. Duckworth and I had met in a case involving the theft of computer software, and from that point forward, I'd come to rely on his advice and assistance in all matters technical. He also dabbled in showbiz, as I did, performing jazz standards and show tunes in clubs, and we had even played some gigs together. The one thing that differentiated us on stage, however, was the fact that he performed in drag. He was eerily convincing as a woman, and that fact had gotten him, and me, into trouble on more than one occasion. He was also chronically unemployed, quote, gay as a French horn, unquote, his phrase, a smart alecus frequentus, my phrase, and tended to look up to me. So I thought of him as the gay, smart-mouthed, slacker son I'd never had. Driving south on Highway 280 after picking him up at his Castro District apartment, I filled Chris in on the assignment and the discovery of Bowman's body. I finished with, "And that's where Ballou comes in." I knew I wouldn't be able to make heads or tails of what he said, so I figured you could be my interpreter. I glanced over at Duckworth and watched him smirk back at me. He was wearing a funky three-quarter-length leather coat with French cuffs and had it wrapped tight around his slender torso to compensate for the anemic performance of the Galaxy heater. He ran his hand through his close-cropped blonde hair. "Your interpreter," he repeated. "Wouldn't that be like explaining the Hegelian dialect to my cat?" "How do you think your cat would do with the infield fly rule?" "I told you," he said. "I only went to that baseball game to see the men in tight pants. Besides, I don't actually think this is such an arcane topic." "Oh, yeah? Well, it strikes me that these machines are computers like any other. You collect data via the screen, process it, and store it on disk or some other form of memory. That means they can be hacked like other computers." "There's got to be some kind of security," I said. "Sure, just like there's got to be security on the FBI website. That didn't stop someone from putting a picture of J. Edgar Hoover in a dress on it." I always wondered who that someone was. I looked over at Chris again, but all he did was make a coy, zip-my-lips gesture. The classic postcard shot of Stanford University is a view down Palm Drive to Memorial Church and the sandstone and red-tiled roofs of the buildings in the quad. What the postcards don't show you are the parking enforcement officers who swarm the oval drive in front of the quad like Brazilian army ants. I was twice dissuaded from parking in a juicy faculty and staff spot by a helmeted minion with a triple-decker ticket book. So I settled for a cozy plot of asphalt in the alley behind the organic chemistry building that was every bit as illegal, but more discreetly so. Professor Ballou's office was, appropriately enough, in a building named after Microsoft founder Bill Gates. The outside of the building was a nice blend of modern design and the California Mission-inspired architecture that dominated the campus. But going down a hallway past dozens of minuscule offices with frosted glass doors, I was reminded of the documentary I saw on Japanese capsule hotels. You would have thought Gates could have sprung for an extra floor in his building to give everyone a little more elbow room. Ballou was in number 434, and his office was every bit as small as the others. He had shoehorned in a desk, a computer, and a couple of guest chairs. But as the Borscht Belt joke goes, if he had any cockroaches in there, they'd be hunchbacked. Baloo himself was small, only a couple inches taller than Chris. He looked to be in his mid-40s, had dirty brown hair running to gray at the temples, and a prominent schnoz with a defined crease running through the tip of it. He wore rimless glasses with thin silver bows, a black turtleneck, and a pair of wrinkled khakis. He shook Chris's and my hands when they were offered, but had trouble making eye contact. He gestured awkwardly at the guest chairs and then dropped into his own in front of his computer, like he was returning to asylum. I had the feeling that he didn't get out much. His fingers scuttled along the keys of the computer keyboard. "Excuse me," he mumbled. "I want to bring up my notes for the meeting."
"Mrs. Lee gave you the background then," I said.
"Yes, of course." He glanced furtively at Chris. "But she didn't say there would be two of you."
"Chris is my part-time assistant. He often helps me with technical matters. He'll keep everything we discuss in confidence, as I will."
"All right," said Baloo into his lap. "What would you like me to cover first?"
"Maybe you could just explain how touchscreen voting systems work in general. I'm afraid I don't even have a very good handle on that."
Baloo brightened, happy to be on familiar ground. "In concept, touchscreen systems are not that much different from traditional systems, except that the votes are stored electronically. Each polling place is equipped with touchscreen machines, which are the equivalent of voting stations in paper-based systems. The machines run software that displays the ballot and captures the voter selections. The only difference is that instead of punching a hole in a paper ballot, the voter touches the appropriate place on the screen to select a candidate. The votes are then written to non-volatile memory within the machine, and when the polling place closes, the memory is removed from the machine and is taken to a central server where the votes are tallied. Some vendors' machines, such as the ones being used in San Francisco, also print a paper audit trail for each vote cast."
"You don't make it sound particularly insecure or error-prone. What are the problems?"
"A touchscreen voting machine is just a computer, a specialized kind of a computer, but a computer nonetheless. Erroneous outcomes could happen for a variety of reasons, including software and hardware errors, procedural errors, security holes, or hacks installed into the voting machines."
Chris held his palms up and looked over at me. "What did I tell you?" I waved him off. "Let's get more specific. Exactly how could you go about changing the outcome of an election?" Baloo glanced at his computer screen and then used the mouse to scroll text down.
"I'm afraid there are many, many different ways, but I'll try to focus on a few of the most likely. First, starting at the polling place, when the memory is removed from the computer, a corrupt poll worker could alter the results for the precinct before turning them in. It's much easier than ballot box stuffing because you only need to change one number, and there's no real need to steal or forge ballots."
Chris squared a book on the corner of Baloo's desk titled Python Cookbook, which I assumed had nothing to do with eating snakes. "But taking that approach would mean you'd only affect the votes for one precinct," he said. "You'd have to corrupt a whole lot of poll workers to really impact an election."
"That's right. If you want one-stop shopping, then the best thing to do is to wait until all the votes are loaded onto the central server. If you can gain access to the network where the election management system runs, then results for the whole election are at your fingertips. It's not dissimilar to a student who wants to cheat in school. It's more efficient to hack into the university system to change the grades for all your courses than to go to the trouble of cheating on individual exams in each class."
"But if I'm trying to catch someone who used that method, who am I looking for?" I asked. "Does it have to be someone in the elections department?" Baloo bit his lip and shook his head like I should have known better.
"No, it would help, of course. But once you put the votes on a network, you have the same security issues you would have with any other computer application. The hacker could be someone outside the election department who suborns an employee, or simply tricks him into giving up his password. Or it could be someone who has no contact with department employees at all,
but finds a vulnerability in the system and exploits it.
So you're saying election results could be hacked this way as a result of negligence, with no actual complicity on the part of election department employees?
Absolutely. Most security breaches are the result of negligence. Failure to password protect an account, for instance. But we haven't even touched on the easiest and most insidious way to rig an election.
Changing the programming of the touchscreen computers, blurted Chris. Baloo looked over at Chris with a surprised look of geek admiration.
Very good, he said warmly.
Chris beamed back at him. Thank you. The setup you gave made it seem obvious. I felt like the busboy at a lunch conversation between Einstein and Newton. Okay, now that we've concluded the mutual admiration portion of our program, you want to explain exactly what you mean? You're saying the touchscreen machines run software?
Weren't you listening earlier, said Chris. You need software to display the ballot, capture the vote, and write it to memory.
Blue nodded.
And think how easy it would be to change the vote someone cast before you write it to memory. You don't even have to be crude about it, like forcing every vote to be for your candidate. You could decide what percentage you want him to win by and change just enough votes so that he wins by that amount. You could even be sensitive to what precincts he's strongest in, changing the most votes in those and fewer votes in precincts where he is weaker.
But it's exactly because Padilla did so well in Chinatown that Mrs. Lee thinks the election is rigged. Baloo shrugged.
What I describe would be a more sophisticated approach. It doesn't mean someone didn't take a brute force one.
I have to ask the question I asked earlier. Who would the someone be? Baloo pushed his keyboard back and made a steeple with his hands.
Now it gets interesting. Sticking with the scenario where the programming of the voting machine is subverted, the obvious choice would be someone associated with the vendor who built the machines. It could be an individual programmer who is paid to make the changes. Or, if you go in for bigger conspiracy theories, it could involve executives at the top. And, like the other scenario, there's also the possibility that someone at the elections department changed the code, or someone completely unaffiliated hacked into the network and made changes.
I leaned back in my chair and tried to swing one leg over the other, but there wasn't enough room in front of Baloo's desk. I dropped my foot to the floor again, frustrated. Inking fingers like they did in the Iraqi election sounds better. Don't these programs get tested to make sure they work properly?
Yes, of course. But there are at least two problems. The first is that a smart programmer would know how to make the code behave properly under a test scenario and only alter votes during a real election. The second is that software is often changed after it's tested, to correct bugs, for instance, and it's often not retested or retested fully before it's installed on the machines. There's a certification process that should be followed for updates, but the fact of the matter is, in the rushed period before the election, last-minute changes are made and installed on the precinct machines without following process. It wouldn't be hard at all for someone to slip in a change program on some or all of the machines.
Baloo glanced down at his watch and raised his eyebrows in what seemed an overly dramatic gesture.
I'm afraid I'm out of time. I had to squeeze you in today. Yesterday I had you down for a full 90 minutes.
I nodded. We've got more than enough to go on. If we do have reason to suspect the election was rigged by altering the software, how could we determine for sure?
If you get a copy of the program that runs on the touchscreen computers, I could determine if it's been programmed to change votes.
Source code or object code? Asked Chris.
Source code would be better. Now, I really must go. I have a database class to teach.
Baloo stood and reached down to grab a windbreaker from his chair. He shrugged it on. We scrambled to stand with him and threaded our way out the office to the corridor. One more thing, I said. Who's the vendor who supplied the machines to the city?
CVT, Columbia Voting Technologies. They're in South San Francisco.
Baloo turned and started trotting down the hallway.
Wait, said Chris. What kind of memory do they use to store the votes?
Baloo slowed and glanced back at Chris. He frowned.
They use flash memory. Some machines use flashcards like digital cameras. I believe the CVT machines use USB drives because they're formatted like regular disks. Now goodbye. He darted around a corner and disappeared from view. I stood in the hallway thinking, jangling the St. Apollonia medal in my pocket. I felt Chris's eyes on me. There's some special reason you asked about the memory, isn't there? He nodded. He reached both hands into the front pocket of his crazy leather frock coat and pulled something small off another object. He held it up for me to see. Look familiar? It was a plastic cap about the size of a chiclet. It looks like the pin cap I found in Bowman's hand. He brought the other object out of his pocket. It was a 3-inch long, fob-like item with a square metal tip. A square metal tip that looked like it was meant to be covered by the cap. This is a flash memory USB drive, said Chris. I use it to transfer files between computers. The cap protects the USB connector when it's not in use. He paused. Bowman was holding the memory from a voting machine when he died. You have been listening to Runoff, a book hard-boiled great James Crumley described as a smart, funny, spooky, often touching, always entertaining romp. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.